jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Stuff at WRCT Pittsburgh. Jazz is a one-syllable word.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
my fellow Americans.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in the majority opinion on Kennedy versus Bremerton that, quote, "The Constitution and the best of our traditions counsel mutual respect and tolerance, not censorship and suppression, for religious and non-religious views alike," close quote. The case was about whether there was a problem with a Washington State assistant football coach leading prayers, Christian prayers, lest you be confused, in the locker room before games and on the field. The Supreme Court that we have today, for reasons, determined that Kennedy was protected in his right to express his personal religious beliefs by dropping a knee on the 50-yard line of a public school playing field and calling on players to join him, and that presented no harm to anyone or to the nominal separation of church and state. If it walks like a duck, and in this case it is, another Supreme Court ruling that bases itself in a reality that really just doesn't exist. This ruling in particular irritates meaningfully because, of course, we know that taking a knee is the sort of gesture that is either a fresh wind of free expression or a horrible affront to the values we hold dear, depending on who does it. So we'll hear today from Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation and author of many books, including most recently The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. And we'll get a little corrective background for corporate media's current conversation about the voices of athletes or performers who are mainly told to shut up and sing, and their actual historical role in social change. We'll get that from journalist and author Howard Bryant. Counterspin talked with him back in June of 2018, and we're going to hear part of that conversation again today. That's coming up, but first, a quick look at some recent press. Of course, all eyes are on the Supreme Court's overturn of Roe v. Wade, a ruling that, while it did not actually protect every person's right to abortion, much less their reproductive rights, still provided cover for doctors providing abortions. Nominally liberal news media do a fair job of relating public opinion, which does now and has for many years supported people's right to end pregnancies for any reason. But that doesn't mean corporate media play no role in the crisis before us. To paraphrase Ari Paul, writing for Fair.org, Neil Gorsuch was appointed after the Republican Senate blocked Barack Obama's nominee to replace Antonin Scalia until after the election. in hopes of retaining a 5-4 conservative balance. Brett Kavanaugh replaced Anthony Kennedy, who stepped down specifically so his seat could continue to be held by a Republican appointee. And the last appointee, Amy Coney Barrett, replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg, solidifying a 6-3 conservative advantage a week before the 2020 presidential election. Barrett's confirmation also exposed the cynicism of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who had blocked Obama's pick for Scalia's seat on the grounds that it was an election year, but then pushed through Barrett's confirmation. All three of these were nominated by a president who did not win the popular vote. Okay, on beer lover Brett Kavanaugh, the New York Times ran two op-eds to make the point that justices often do not perform the way partisans and the news media expect them to. They also ran columnist Brett Stevens' argument that liberals always cry wolf about threats to reproductive rights. The Washington Post seemed to make getting Neil Gorsuch confirmed a crusade. In the first 48 hours after Gorsuch was nominated by Donald Trump, the Post published 30 articles, op-eds, blog posts, and editorials, not one of which was critical or in opposition. Evidently, columns like "Ignore the attacks on Neil Gorsuch, he's an intellectual giant and a good man," required no sort of balance. And then on Barrett, the Post ran a piece telling readers that liberals have nothing to fear from her because her religion leads to her commitment to treating others with respect. In all three of Trump's nominees, nominally liberal-leading major media outlets told readers that the fears that these justices would undo Warren Court decisions upholding civil rights were overblown. All of which is only to say maybe those same media outlets aren't the place to look for answers about what to do now that that didn't work out. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. While we still reel from the theft of bodily autonomy from half the population, the right-wing-dominated Supreme Court has delivered other blows to principles that many believed were assured. In Kennedy versus Bremerton, a 6-3 ruling determined that Washington State High School assistant football coach Joseph Kennedy had a right to pray in the locker room and on the field. And why should a person be denied their right to what the court described as a short, personal, private exercise of their religious beliefs? As our guest and others want us to understand, the court's ruling relies on a storyline that just doesn't match the reality and is much less about freedom than about coercion. Dave Zirin is the sports editor at The Nation and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. He's also author of numerous books about sports and their intersection with history, politics, and social justice, including What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, and most recently, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World, which is out now from New Press. He joins us now by phone from Tacoma Park. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dave Zirin.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I can feel the heat coming off your piece on this, and I think it's because of the boldly false premise of this ruling about the role of coach prayer generally, but in particular about Kennedy. You say that this ruling is wrong from the opening statement. So maybe let's start there.
Well, here's the issue. It's a cliche, but it's true. You know, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And in the decision that was written by Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, he relied on his own facts. Let's put it more simply. He lied in describing what took place in the Bremerton versus Washington, I believe it's called, the case. And here's the thing. Coach Kennedy was not off, as Gorsuch writes, praying on his own. He was not off quietly doing this, and he was not fired for doing it. So they painted a narrative of this coach looking for a quiet corner to pray, and then this school board with pitchforks and torches in hand forcing Kennedy out of his job. None of this happened. I mean, what Kennedy did in praying in the locker room, and then particularly his prayers after the game on the field, was draw in players to surround him in prayer, asking players to do testimonials about God. All of this thing creates like this kind of maelstrom of pressure on the players that if you are down with your coach, you will pray with your coach. And if you're not down with that, then, hey, you're free not to pray with the coach. But anybody who's ever played high school sports knows that if you don't do what the coach says, particularly in an autocratic sport like football, you're going to pay a price for that. You're going to pay a price for it, whether it's in terms of playing time or maybe even worse for the high school level, you're going to pay a price for it in terms of being outcast, in terms of being seen as a locker room distraction, or even worse in the parlance of sports, a locker room cancer. And that is what the Supreme Court basically said could now take place, is a process of bullying in high school sports to make players feel coerced into praying with their coach. And that's unconscionable. It's absolutely unconscionable. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from folks, including tons of stories about what it was like to play high school sports at private or religious institutions and the degree of religious peer pressure that would take place and how it would alienate, ostracize, and all the rest of it. And I should probably add that, you know, we would be completely, completely naive if we didn't just see this as an issue of prayer, but this is about Christian prayer. Like, right. If the coach was Jewish, if he was Muslim, Hindu, whatever you want, religion, Shinto,
right,
or wanted to do a prayer of atheism, you know, beforehand, there would be a very different response from this court than Christianity, because this court has shown itself to be proudly in a relationship with a kind of Christo-fascism, which is quickly overcoming the ruling structures of the United States, if not the people themselves.
Well, and just to underscore the idea of the false narrative, you know, Danny Westneed in the Seattle Times, very close to the issue, wrote a story in which he was saying, as you have said, that Kennedy explained himself. He said he was inspired to start these midfield prayers after he saw an evangelical Christian movie called Facing the Giants, you know, in which a losing team finds God, Christian God, and then goes on to win the state championship. So the very idea that he was trying to find a personal private space to pray in private and that he was being denied that, it's just wholly not true.
And can I say something else? The school district, and I say this as somebody who made phone calls, spoke to people, and I'm not just saying this for the purposes of my own narrative. They made every effort to try to accommodate Coach Kennedy. They made every effort to create spaces for him to pray. And they did not fire him when he repeatedly ignored what they had to say, thumbed his nose what they had to say. Look, my wife is a teacher, and if she thumbed her nose at the rules of the district to the degree that Coach Kennedy was doing, she would have found herself out of work. Now, Coach Kennedy, again and again, thumbing his nose at what they're saying to him. And in the end, you know what they did? They didn't fire him. They suspended him with pay, with the opportunity to reapply back for his job. And partly because I think they realized how hot button this was. They made every effort to try to look like partners in trying to figure this out. And, you know, they wanted to look like, we want to collaborate with you to find a solution that actually helps and, you know, makes everybody feel validated. And I think what they learned, which I think a lot of us need to learn, is that there is a political movement in this country that's playing for keeps. You know, they don't care how nice you're going to be about it. They don't care if you're willing to meet them halfway. I mean, they're not trying for a bigger piece of the pie. They're trying to take over the bakery right now. And I think the sooner we realize that, the better. because a lot of people in the ruling corridors of the Democratic Party really seem to have not gotten the memo.
Well, it's important that it integrates with sports and with athletics here, which I think makes it slot into a different place in some people's brains. This ruling, it galls, of course, for many reasons, but part of it is the ability for people who have a public platform to express political or social concerns, whether they're athletes or musicians or artists, it's framed so differently depending on who they are and what they're saying.
Exactly.
It's related, but if I can just transition you, you've written about Muhammad Ali, about Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been true that there's been a kind of policing of what people can say if it's decided that they're outside of their purview.
Yeah, you know, if I could say something about that. I wrote this book, The Kaepernick Effect. I interviewed dozens of young people who, a lot of them in high school, who took a knee. And they were invariably subject to all kinds of ostracization, pushed away, I mean, pushed off the team, made to feel outcast from the team, oftentimes at the behest of the coach. And I think one of the things that we need to come to grips with is that this kind of aggressive, Supreme Court-led Christian posturing is political. Because people say, well, that's just religious what the coach is doing. Taking a knee during the anthem, that's a political act, and politics have no place in sports. Do you honestly think it's not political that this coach is defying the school district time and again, is drawing in students into the prayer circle time and again, is thumbing his nose at the concerns of parents time and again, and now, and if I wish I could bet money on this, is going to be on the right-wing gravy train probably for the next decade, doing speeches time and again. And maybe they'll even be one of those Hollywood movies that only a small segment of the population see, starring, I don't know, Gina Carano and Kevin Sorbo, whatever, you know, the actors who occupy that space. And I think we need to realize that these onward Christian soldiers, like, that's not just a song to them. This is a movement that they're trying to build, and trying to collaborate and figure out common solutions, I think, is going to be a very, very difficult task because their eye is not on reconciliation.
Right, right. Thank you for that. And I'm going to let you go, but while I have you, I can't resist. Today's New York Times, quote, more than 4 months after she was first detained, the WNBA star Brittany Griner is expected to appear in a Russian courtroom on Friday for the start of a trial on drug charges that legal experts said was all but certain to end in a conviction, despite the clamor in the United States for her release, close quote. I know I'm asking a lot in a short amount of time, but I know that for a lot of listeners who follow media closely, they're going to say, wait, there was a clamor in the United States for Brittany Griner's release? Wait, who's Brittany Griner? You know, thoughts on that.
We need a much bigger clamor, is my first thought. I mean, Brittany Griner is a WNBA superstar. If her name was Tom Brady, or Steph Curry, I mean, there would be a national day of action to try to get them freed from a Russian prison. I mean, Brittany Griner is a political prisoner. Make no mistake about it.
In Russia.
In Russia.
We care about Russia, right?
Yeah. Facing 10 years behind bars, 5 years at labor behind bars. I mean, this has nothing to do with drugs. I have serious doubts in the charges in the first place. This is about Ukraine. This is about political posturing. This is about this new Cold War that we're dealing with Putin. And this is about them trying to extract political prisoners out of the United States who are Russian in an exchange. And I think we need to apply pressure to our own State Department that bringing Brittany Griner home should be an immediate priority. What's disturbing is the concern that Brittany Griner, because she's a woman athlete, because she's from the LGBTQ community, because she presents in a certain way, that she's just not getting the coverage or the attention that she otherwise would get. And I think that's one of the things also we need to fight against. It's not just about injustice in Russia. It's about standing up to injustice and prejudice here at home.
We've been speaking with Dave Zirin. He's sports editor at The Nation, and you can follow his work at edgeofsports.com. Dave Zirin, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Football assistant coach Joseph Kennedy fought his desire to take a knee all the way to the Supreme Court. For listeners who might not remember, when then San Francisco 49er Colin Kaepernick sought to join thousands of others in expressing his outrage and sorrow at the killing of black people by police, he spoke with, among others, Nate Boyer, another football player for the Seattle Seahawks who had been a Green Beret. And Boyer suggested that rather than sit out the national anthem, Kaepernick should take a knee, the way, he said, soldiers take a knee in front of a fallen soldier's grave as a way to express dissent without disrespect. We've seen critics, including in the press, tellingly describe Kaepernick's gesture as an insolent refusal to stand rather than an action consciously chosen, much as many people still believe Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus because her feet were tired. Counterspin talked about the long history of athletes' activism in 2018 with sports reporter Howard Bryant, author of the book The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism, which is out from Beacon Press. I asked Howard Bryant about disrupting the narrative of black athletes as evidence of racial equity in the United States.
I think one of the things that's been really interesting in trying to figure out how to tell this type of story, because there's so much to it, is where do you start and how do you put this together? And for me, the genesis of this had been this revival of this heritage. If you're of a certain age, you remember Muhammad Ali and you remember the memories, of course, of Jackie Robinson, and you remember Bill Russell and all of these athletes, John Carlos, Tommy Smith in the 68 Olympics. You remember these players being very prominent and you remember them being advocates for African Americans. If you're of a different generation, if you were, say, born in the 80s or even the 90s, this revival, the appearance of athletes taking a political stance, being involved in their community, being involved in social issues on a national level, is completely foreign because you grew up with the Michael Jordans and Tiger Woods being the model. So for me, what I thought was really sort of interesting and important was to remind people that the black athlete has been involved in the political struggle from the beginning, and that these players have had a very special place in American history. The argument that I make in the book is that the black athlete is the most important and most influential and most visible black employee in the 20th century, because they're the ones who were allowed to integrate the society, whether it was the military, whether it was education, whether it was swimming pools. It was the ball players who came first. And because of that, they've had a responsibility to stand up and to advocate. So we recognize them when they're not there, and we remember them when they are.
And with that comes this bind, you know, this visibility as a real representation of integration, and yet still being a black American. And in terms of the history and the beginning, I think a lot of folks would be very, very surprised to hear that it starts with Paul Robeson.
Absolutely. It starts with Paul Robeson. And of course, people don't realize that he played in the National Football League. He played football before he was the great baritone, before he was the great singer and the great actor and the great activist. And one of the only reasons that he left professional football was because the National Football League was integrated and then it chose segregation until 1946. So when he played 1921 and 1922, football was integrated, and then by 1923, no blacks were allowed to play in the NFL for another quarter century. It wasn't just Robeson to me that I gravitated toward when tracing this heritage. It was also the fact that the African-American athlete's political roots did not start with black issues. It started with Jewish issues. It started with World War II. It started with American athletes being asked to defend America against Nazism and Jewish athletes asking for solidarity against the Berlin Olympics in 1936, and also, of course, asking Jackie Robinson to denounce Paul Robeson in 1949 in support of America during the Cold War. So it wasn't until much later, it wasn't until you had Robinson in that testimony receive all the attention for his denouncing of Paul Robeson, but also inside of that testimony, he talked about inequality and police brutality and mistreatment of African Americans and fairness and all of these things that would become the foundations of this heritage. It started with Robinson, but not along racial lines to begin with. It started with defending America.
I find Robinson's HUAC testimony to be maybe the most moving part of the book and such a clear, first of all, a thing that's so misremembered.
Completely.
You know.
We chose to emphasize the part that made America feel good.
Right.
Which was, see, Jackie Robinson is a real American because he denounced Paul Robeson, the bad Negro communist. I don't even think we misremembered everything. We just chose to ignore it. And when I started to read that testimony when I was doing the research, I was wondering, did I know this? I think I kind of knew this, but maybe I really didn't either.
Right.
And that's what we do. We decide to omit. One of the great favorite colleagues and the great writer, David Marinus, once said to me that history writes people out of the story, and it's our job to write them back in. And I think that Robinson testimony is something that needed to be written back in.
Absolutely. Well, you know, history's moving along, and owners and teams are aware that integration is happening, but I like how you note that this idea that became popular and still holds sway, that, oh, they're only looking for the best players, that was fiction always. And there's this note that Earl Wilson, when Earl Wilson was signed to the Boston Red Sox, the scouting report described him as a, quote, well-mannered colored boy, not too black, pleasant to talk to, close quote.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this story of integration, but then Black athletes are making money, and some of them are making a tremendous amount of money. And so that gives them a bigger megaphone and at the same time more calls not to use it.
For caution, absolutely. And I think that's this tension that the Black athlete has that even other Black entertainers don't have. Why are we now talking about Oprah Winfrey as a potential presidential candidate? Because she has money. And we talk about Mark Cuban as a presidential candidate, or Donald Trump as president, or Michael Bloomberg as the mayor of New York because they were all rich. When it comes to the Black athlete, though, what we want from them in exchange for the money is silence. We don't want to hear from them. We want them to be quiet. We want them to shut up and play or shut up and dribble. And this is the one area where money is not affording you a bigger voice. And that goes back to this very interesting relationship that we tend to have with our sports figures, that there's an ownership to them, that they don't necessarily get to be citizens, that their job is to entertain us. And I think that's one of the areas where this heritage has become so polarizing in a lot of ways, is this feeling of ownership is now colliding with the fact that you have this new generation of Black athletes, post-Trayvon Martin, post-Ferguson, post-Eric Garner and Sandra Bland, who are now citizens, especially thanks to the prevalence of social media. They're watching these viral videos just like the rest of us are on YouTube, and they're looking at this dash cam footage. And one of the things that one of the players, Tavon Austin, had said, who played for the St. Louis Rams when he came out in 2014 with the hands up, don't shoot gesture before a game, was, it's hard for me to go back to my community knowing that this is going on, knowing that I've got a platform and all my friends and family are looking at me going, people listen to you and you're not saying anything. That's the heritage.
That was journalist and author Howard Bryant speaking with Counterspin in 2018. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Al-Ateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Al-Ateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
The lights in the harbor don't shine for me. I'm like a lost ship adrift on the sea. Sea of heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on the sea of tears, sea of heartbreak. Heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. How I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm a sea of tears, sea of heartbreak.
Watch the lightning when it lights up the sky. You know it makes me feel good. Well, I love a rainy night, such a beautiful sight. I love to feel the rain on my face, taste the rain on my lips, in the moonlight shadows. Showers wash all my cares away. I wake up to a sunny day, 'cause I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. Ooh, ooh. I love a rainy night. I love a rainy night. I love to hear the thunder, watch the lightning when it lights up the sky. You know it makes me feel good. Well, I love a rainy night, it's such a beautiful sight. I love to feel the rain on my face, taste the rain on my lips, in the moonlight shadows.
puts a song in this heart of mine, puts a smile on my face every time, 'cause I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Ooh, I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Ooh, ooh. Shadows wash all my cares away. Sunny day, 'cause I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. I love a rainy night. Well, I love.
When we walk down the street, I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know you're mine until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat. Well, I did a double take the day I met you. My heart turned to flip as I stood next to you. And I knew right there I never could forget you. For you are my every dream come true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know you're mine until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat. You came in. Turn my cloudy skies from gray to blue. You're my sunshine that comes up every morning. Yes, you are my every dream come true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know you're mine until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat.
One fine day as I was walking down the street, spied a beggar man with rags upon his feet. Took a penny from my pocket in his tin cup, I did drop it, and I heard him say as I made my retreat,
"May the bird of paradise fly up your nose, may an elephant caress you with his toes, may your wife be plagued with runners in her hose, may the bird of paradise fly up your nose."
My laundry man is really on his toes. Found a $100 bill among my clothes. When he called me, I came running, gave him back his dime for phoning, and I heard him saying as I turned to go, "Been a bird of paradise, fly up your nose. Been an elephant to rest you with his toes. Me, your wife, be plagued with runners in her hose. I was way behind one day to catch a train. The taxi driver said, "We'll make it just the same." A speed cop made it with us, and as he wrote out the ticket, I stood by politely waiting for my change.
Been a bird of paradise, fly up your nose. Been an elephant to rest you with his toes.
Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up and she's a-running like I never before. There's a speed zone ahead with all right. I don't see a cop in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. I got me 10 forward gears on a Georgia overdrive. Taking little white pills in my eyes, I open wide. I just passed a Jimmy in a wine. I've been a-passing everything in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. But it seems like a month since I kissed my baby goodbye. I could have a lot of women, but I'm not like a some of the guys. I could find one to hold me tight, but I could never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. ICC is a checking on down the line. Well, I'm a little overweight and my logbook's way behind. But nothing bothers me tonight. I can dodge all the scales all right. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. Well, my rig's a little old, but that don't mean she's slow. There's a flame from her stack and that smoke's a-blowing black as coal. My hometown's a-coming in sight. If you think I'm happy, you're right. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home
down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet you're gonna regret, cause I'm the best as ever been."
"Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul."
Up his case and he said, "I'll start this show and fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow. And he pulled the bow across the strings and it made an evil hiss. And then a band of demons joined in and it sounded something like this. Devil finished, Johnny said, well, you're pretty good, old son, but sit down in that chair right there and let me show you how it's done. Fire on the mountain, run, boys, run. The devil's in the house of the rising sun. Chicken in the bread pan, picking out dough. Granny, does your dog bite? No child, no. The devil bowed his head because he knew that he'd been beat. And he laid that golden fiddle on the ground at Johnny's feet. Johnny said, devil, just come on back if you ever want to try again. I done told you once, you son of a bitch, I'm the best there's ever been. He played, found the mountain, run, boys, run. Devil's in the house of the rising sun. The chicken in the bread pan, I'm picking out dough. Granny, will you don't fight, no child, no.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Working in this factory for now 15 years. All this time I watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. And I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off of my back if I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Well, that foreman, he's a regular dog. Line boss, he's a fool. Got a brand new flat top haircut. Lord, thinks he's cool. One of these days I'm gonna blow my top and that sucker, he's gonna pay. Lord, I can't wait to see their faces when I get the nerve to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Take this job and shove it.
DJs knows that I'm an outlaw. They'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. Loudmouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair. I guess he ain't read the signs that say I've been to prison. Someone ought to warn him before I knock him off his chair. 'Cause my long hair just can't cover up my redneck. I've won every fight I've ever fought, and I don't need some turkey telling me that I ain't country, saying I ain't worth a damn dough ticket that he bought. 'Cause I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. They tell me I look like Merle Haggard and sound a lot like David Allen Coe. And the barmaid in the last town that we played in knew the words to every song I'd wrote. She said Jimmy Rabbit turned her on to my last album just about the time the jukebox broke. Yeah, Johnny Cash helped me get out of prison long before Rodriguez stole that goat. I've been the Rhinestone Cowboy for so long I can't remember, and I can do you every song Hank Williams ever wrote. And I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. I can't help it, I look like Merle Haggard, and I sound a lot like David Allen Coe. But the country DJs all think I'm an outlaw, and they'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. The loud mouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair.
I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh. I went to sleep in Detroit City, and I dreamed about those cotton fields and home. I dreamed about my mother, dear old papa, sister and brother. I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, how I wanna go home. Home folks think I'm big in Detroit City, from the letters that I write they think I'm fine. But by day I make the cards, by night I make the bars. If only they could read
between the lines. 'Cause you know, I rode a freight train north to Detroit City. And after all these years, I find I've just been wasting my time. So I just think I'll take my foolish pride and put it on a southbound freight and ride. Go on back to the loved ones, the ones that I left waiting so far behind. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, how I wanna go home.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
Her since she up and walked away, and I'll bet you dread to spend another lonely night with me. But lonely walls, I'll keep you company. Hello, Wendell. Well, I see that you're still here. Aren't you lonely? Since our darling disappeared. Well, look here, is that a teardrop in the corner of your pain? Now don't you try to tell me that it's rain. She went away and left us all alone the way she planned. Guess we'll have to learn to get along without her if we can. Hello, ceiling.
Hello.
I'm gonna stare at you a while. You know I can't sleep, so won't you bear with me a while? We must all stick together, or else I'll lose my mind.
Hi, I'm Melinda Crawford, a Scottish fiddler, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando!
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WTC and WTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from Keysport, Pennsylvania. I am your host, Mando Richard, and I've got quite the show planned. We're originating again from the studios of WRCT Pittsburgh. So it's not 100% predictable what's going to happen, but we've got a liquored up set at the beginning. We'll have a gospel set at the end, and who knows what'll happen in between. Well, let's get the liquored up set started, shall we? Here come the Morgantown Rounders with Dance All Night with a Bottle in Your Hand.
Bottle in your hand, bottle in your hand, bottle in your hand. Dance all night with the bottle in your hand, just for a nigga fiddler grand. Sitting on a fence, ain't seen nothing on my jawbone since. So walk on home, couldn't get along. Here comes Sally with the pigtails on. She took it off and I put it on. Here comes Sally with the red dress on. Fill them up again, old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill them up again, just for a dang and fiddler dram.